And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am so excited about this conversation that you are about to hear, a conversation with two filmmakers responsible for a truly remarkable documentary film that airs on PBS stations across the country tomorrow night, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, airing as part of the series Independent Lens. This particular film titled Free for All, The Public Library. And I suspect that the public radio audience as a whole could not be a more ideal target for this particular film. Every public radio listener I know loves books, loves bookstores, and loves and appreciates libraries and public libraries and what they represent, what they stand for, the important role that they have played in American life and American culture, and of course, in other places around the world as well. But even for those of us who love our local public library, our frequent visitors, patrons, supporters, this is a history that I suspect most of us do not know nearly as well as we should. And I feel like I learned a tremendous amount from watching this film called Free for All, The Public Library, which helps us understand the long history of public libraries, why they were created in the first place, and how this history has been fraught with various tensions and controversies over the years. And, of course, some of those tensions and controversies are very much playing out in the present day. But those controversies, in a sense, are nothing new. Maybe some of the specifics are different in terms of how they are playing out. But for a long time, people have contended with one another about what public libraries are, whom they should serve, and in what ways. And one comes away from this beautiful and at many times deeply personal film with a profound new understanding of what public libraries represent and the difference that they have made in so many people's lives over the years. Again, the film airs tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. The film, again, titled Free for All, The Public Library. I'm happy to be joined by the two producers of the film, Don Logsdon and Lucy Faulkner. And we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Don Logsdon, it is your voice that we hear as the narrator in this wonderful film. And there are certain aspects of your own personal life and personal connection to public libraries that really form, in some respects, the emotional heart of this film and maybe serve as a significant framework to how this story is told. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about, and in particular, the lovely story that we hear towards the very beginning in which you talk about a certain hurricane and the decision that your own mother made in making preparations for that encroaching storm.
Sure. My mom is actually originally from Milwaukee and moved to New Orleans, not knowing anyone, pregnant with my sister, with a two-year-old who was me. And soon after they got there, soon after they got there, Hurricane Betsy was on its way, and she had no idea what that meant. She couldn't understand why her neighbors were all rushing around getting supplies, and she just thought, oh, you know, we might lose some power for a while. I'm going to get some new books to read to the kids. And she took us to the public library, and I just remember it very, very vividly because we did lose power. It was really scary for a small child, and she just kept reading me my favorite book, which was The Little Engine That Could.
And from what you tell us in the film, this really, in a sense, marked you in terms of having a really profound appreciation for the public library, which, from the sounds of it, has never abated over the course of these many years since.
No. Only time it abated was when they were all closed during COVID, and I couldn't go to one. But then I did finally learn how to check out everything online, so that was... The libraries were still up and running and serving people. You just couldn't go to them in person.
Absolutely. And of course, that was a moment when a lot of us, I think, in some respects, had a new or reawakened appreciation for what public libraries have to offer. So I wonder if either or both of you could sort of share the story of how this particular film came about. And was it your idea, or did Independent Lens come to you wanting a film to be made about public libraries in America and their history? What is the genesis of this project and what ultimately became this really wonderful film?
It was Lucy's idea.
Thank you. Yeah. It was my idea. We have been working on another film in New Orleans about a neighborhood, and we were spending a lot of time in the libraries and in the archives. And the librarians were just so incredibly helpful. Whenever we had a question, they would either have the answer and they say, oh, I don't know, I'll get back to you on that. And by the time you got back to your desk, they'd have that answer and then three other alternatives and, you know, cited the sources and everything. It was just amazing. But it wasn't until we were almost done with our other film, it was called Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans, we experienced, Don and I together, another hurricane. It was Hurricane Katrina, and we were living in New Orleans. We left that morning before the storm hit. We went up to Baton Rouge, and we thought, you know, we were watching the news in New Orleans, you know, dodged the bullet, but then the levees broke, and we could not go home. We rescued our cat by boat 2 weeks after the storm. Thankfully, we had press passes in order to get in, but everything was under martial law. But before that, when we realized we weren't able to go home, we didn't have our computers or anything, so we went to the East Baton Rouge Public Library, and there we discovered that librarians were first responders because they were there to sign everybody up for library cards so they could get on the computer, so that they could get FEMA information, they could their insurance information, they could look for loved ones that were lost, dogs that were lost. Everything was, you know, online. We could see our house underwater with these satellite images. I mean, it was amazing. And so that's when that sort of solidified that we said, yeah, we got to do a story about this. And it wasn't until about 2010 when we had the wherewithal to start it again. The libraries were shutting. I mean, Silicon Valley, which is, you know, so much money there, they were closing their libraries. They're only opening it one day a week. And we're like, what is going on here? So because of the funding crisis, and we couldn't imagine a life without libraries, we started the film.
Mm, wonderful. Dawn, I think you make mention in your voiceover that over the course of the last, I think you say last decade, you have made a concerted effort to visit a wide array of public libraries all across the country. And I'm suspecting, Lucy Faulkner, you've been part of that sort of exploration process as well. Before we dig into kind of the narrative arc of the film, I would love to hear from both of you about this sort of experience of exploration, of making a point of visiting all kinds of libraries, and from what we see in your film, a dizzying array of public libraries. I mean, from the grand and spectacular to the incredibly small and humble. Tell us a little bit about this exploratory portion of your research for this film.
So we are both city girls. Lucy's a fourth generation San Francisco library user, and I grew up using the library primarily in New Orleans. But when we would travel, we'd go all over. On vacation, we'd go to all these small libraries, particularly in the Midwest, where a lot of my relatives live. And initially, we thought we were going to make a film about one big urban library that was sort of like the life in the day of a library from beginning to end, where we filmed there for a year. And we had narrowed it down to Queens, San Francisco, and Chicago. And we started filming in San Francisco because that was where we were located, and we didn't have any funding yet, so it was easy to do that. And after we'd been shooting for several months, we showed it to some people at the American Library Association conference, And all the librarians there were like, this is great, it's fascinating, but San Francisco doesn't have the problem. It has its own unique problems, but it doesn't have the problems that most of, or the challenges that most libraries are facing right now, which was budget crisis, because San Francisco's is one of the best funded in the country. So at that point, I started thinking back a lot to my memories of small town libraries. They were the ones that were facing the biggest budget threats. And I think in a way they maybe shaped me even more than my city library did, because it would be a very solitary thing. I would go there all alone and spend the whole day there. And we realized more and more once we started traveling that those public libraries in small towns are often the very last public gathering place, where you either don't have to be of the same denomination when you go to church, or where you don't have to spend some money, like at a coffee shop. And that they've really come to become sort of the last standing public commons in a lot of small towns. And so we sort of shifted our focus more in that direction.
I just want to say, I should think that was probably a really interesting moment to, you know, as you have this film, and maybe I'm making an assumption here, but I'm kind of assuming that you loved what you had done, felt good about it, and were probably expecting just a cascade of praise and thanks from these librarians, and which was part of their response. But of course, part of their response was to say, you're missing an enormous swath of this story. I should think that was maybe a disconcerting moment for the two of you.
Let's just say we were a little discouraged, but
I think we were energized too. We were energized.
I mean, that's part of making documentary film, is you start out with one idea and you always end up with a different film, because it's based on what you actually experience when you're out there filming, and also how current events change.
So tell us then about that sort of second half of the journey, in which you realized there was this whole other world of public libraries that you had not given sufficient consideration of or attention to, and then how you ended up seeking out, for instance, those small rural libraries that we get to see in your film. Not that they were exactly hidden, but in a sense, how did you find them? How did you choose them? How did they cross your path?
You know, in a way, they sort of are hidden to the mainstream press, I think. The big, you know, East Coast and West Coast outlets that do a lot of the coverage for national stories. I don't think that those small libraries are really on their radar in the same way. And certainly they weren't when we were trying to fund the project. So what happened was, I started with my mom on a road trip in Wisconsin, revisiting some of the childhood libraries that she had taken me to. And a lot of them are no longer functioning, mainly because the buildings have become obsolete for the needs of their communities, or they've been torn down, the original old Carnegie buildings. But every town in Wisconsin practically has a library, and it's one of the very thriving systems. And we sort of spread out from there across the country. What happened, two things happened. One is that I fell in love with the history. So I was less... originally planning to make this a historical film. It was going to have like a little history chapter at the beginning. And the more I traveled and the more I learned about the history of each of these individual branches, the more I got fascinated with the history. Because I don't know how much you knew about library history, but I knew almost nothing, even though I've like spent so much time in them. And the little bit I did know was basically Benjamin Franklin, Melville Dewey, Andrew Carnegie. And they're all in the film. And they're all fascinating characters. But as we were traveling to these little libraries, what people were telling me was not Andrew Carnegie. I mean, they were like, oh yeah, Andrew Carnegie paid for the building. But the people who really started this library were such and such women's club that's been located in our town forever. And they were the ones who wrote the letters to Andrew Carnegie. They were the ones who lobbied the city leaders, who at that time, of course, were all men, to get the library, the land for it. They were the ones who did the first book drive to get the books for it. And that story just kept repeating over and over and over again, every little town that we went to. And so that sort of shifted my focus to like learning that history.
Right. At some...
I'm sorry, for the contemporary parts of the film. We went to a lot of American Library Association meetings, conferences. They're huge, and in those are so many little breakout rooms. And there's the library history round table. There's the, you know, everybody's got their little round table, and everybody has their own little stories in there. And so we started listening and sitting in on some of these things, and we found a bunch of really interesting librarians, contemporary librarians, that we followed around, like the bookmobile woman from Baton Rouge, Tamika. She was just so fascinating. And then we were invited to the Wisconsin Library Association annual meeting, and gave a little presentation. And then we found Elizabeth Timmons, who's the who won Best Librarian of the Year in Wisconsin, up in Seymour, home of the hamburger. And we just got really lucky. And then we started calling around some other places, and we found the Kirschberg family, and in Douglas County, we heard about that whole system closing. So it was we had our ear to the ground.
Mm. Well, and the film is so much richer because of it. For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today on the morning show with the two producers of a really wonderful film called Free for All, The Public Library. It essentially tells much of the history of how public libraries came to dot the American landscape, the radical idea that was at the heart of creating such an institution, and a history of the way in which sometimes public libraries have been under fire, the source of controversy, the target of protests of one kind or another. And along the way, we meet a host of amazing people who were part of this story. At one point, someone talks about this being, that is the free public library movement, a movement with thousands of unsung heroes. And we meet those heroes, and actually they're mostly heroines in this story. And we are so happy to have with us Lucy Faulkner and Don Logsdon, who are the co-producers of this really remarkable film. Don Logsdon, I know that you may not be able to stay with us to the very end of this interview, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about some other family connections that come up in the source of this, through the course of this film. And it's one of the things that I think really sets this film apart from something that we might otherwise see on another series. I mean, it, in a sense, is a way in which this film is maybe more specifically and deeply personal than it might otherwise be. And along the way, as you are talking about some of your own, let's say, ancestors, we also get a taste of sort of differing attitudes about libraries and the free exchange of ideas and so on. I just want to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about this really personal element of the film beyond the story you've already told about your own mother and so on.
Sure. So the more we were collecting other people's stories, the more I was struck by how personal a lot of them are, and also how, unlike so much else in our country, which is really starkly politically divided right now, these stories were coming from people all across the political spectrum. And I must say that within my own extended family, we have that entire political spectrum. And it's one of the few things I think we all agree on and hold dear, along with public parks and a lot of major public institutions. And so I got curious about how the library had affected my family beyond my parents' generation, because they were very much, they're the youngest in their families. They were both born during World War II, and they had opportunities that weren't open to their parents or their older siblings even, which were to go to free universities and like sort of enter into the educated white collar class. And so I started digging backwards a little bit. They're both, my dad is the son of an immigrant and my mom is the granddaughter of an immigrant. So I went back to my great grandmother on the farm in Wisconsin. And it was actually originally a librarian who led me there, a historical librarian that a lot of people were talking about when we started talking to, there's a whole field of study called library history, and there are some wonderful historians who specialize in that. And one name that came up a lot was a woman named Ludi Stearns, who is credited in large part with spreading libraries throughout the state of Wisconsin and then also beyond to other Midwestern states at some point when she went on speaking tours. And I was like, looking at the names, and they were all very familiar to me from places where my family lived. And sure enough, I looked her up, and she went to a spot that my grandfather was a kid in right before World War, so it would have been like 10 years before World War I, when he was just starting to learn to read. And I remember him talking about these little book boxes arriving in their village, and it was the only book there practically. They had like two books in the one-room school. And all of a sudden, like, his world just exploded bigger when this box of books arrived. But that his mom didn't really so much approve of all those books coming in. And that got me started on the idea that, like, oh, this is sort of the rural small town side of the American experience. And I can tell that through my mom's side. And on my dad's side, it was much more the crowded urban immigrant neighborhood story. When my dad went there literally for safety. And also to study.
One of the things, as you tell us the story of, so would it be your grandmother then, the black and white photograph of this stern-looking woman holding her Norwegian Bible, a great-grandmother, okay, holding this this Norwegian Bible in her lap. And it really kind of helps us understand that when we are talking about a history like this and about a thing like the rise of public libraries, that it is such a mistake to kind of paint this in black and white terms of good guys and bad guys, and that, you know, even for somebody like your great grandmother, I'm sure a wonderful human being in so many ways, and someone who I'm sure loved her family in many, many ways, nevertheless, she set a tone in which the reading of books from this book box had to be done in a sense in secret, because she had such misgivings about the sudden influx of new ideas into that tiny little community. I mean, in a sense, it humanizes something that otherwise it's really easy to think about in more simplistic terms.
I couldn't say it better. I completely agree. And you know, that story just kept coming up over and over and over again. We started looking into some famous people in American history and what their library stories were. And Ronald Reagan came from a troubled home where he would seek solace by escaping to the library and sitting on the front steps and reading stories of superheroes. And Barack Obama did the same thing when he was without either of his parents and his grandparents were raising him. He would go to the library in Honolulu and try and learn more about his father's tribe in Africa. Janis Joplin was a misfit kid who was tormented and volunteered at the library, in her tiny library in Texas. Clarence Thomas tells over and over again the story of how he would never have gotten an education if it hadn't been for his, at that time, unfortunately segregated public library in Savannah, Georgia. So it really... we were just fascinated by how much it, across the political spectrum, everything was.
Absolutely.
The word radical is utilized at that portion in the film when we hear about essentially the first significant free public library to open, I believe, in Boston. And I think it's important for us to maybe just reapproach that whole notion of something as basic as a public library being, in the eyes of some, a truly radical idea. What was so radical about this?
America was a radical idea. You know, we're coming off of the revolution where the idea that all, at least at that time, all white men who owned property would be allowed to vote. That was a radical idea. And the expansion of it into all white men who don't own property, but even are like very poor, destitute immigrants who have just gotten off the boat. And that's where the library story starts, right at that point, where there's a huge, huge masses of uneducated, I mean, it's not where the library story starts. It starts in these little New England towns, but where it really takes off is... in the 1850s right before the Civil War, when the predominantly at that time group of Anglo-Saxon American leaders are like, what are we going to do with all these immigrants who don't speak our language, who aren't educated, who can vote now? And the story just sort of spreads out from there. And the idea that women could go to the library and should be allowed to read fiction was a radical idea at one point. Certainly the idea that you should allow slaves or any people of color into the library was a radical idea. Here's one I didn't know. Children in the library was a radical idea. So for a very long time, children weren't allowed, or they had to be, you know, over 13 and they had to be boys. And it's really a beautiful American story of like the American ideals expanding into reality at the library for more and more and more people throughout our history.
Right. I mean, and speaking of history, your film touches on the now sort of extraordinary reality that for centuries, most libraries, if not all libraries, were locked. I mean, these precious books were locked away, and it was all but unthinkable for just a regular person, for instance, a peasant, to have access to what were thought of as precious treasures. Dawn Loxton, I want to make sure that you have a chance to talk about one of a number of important librarians from American history whose names are all but forgotten. And there's a beautiful sequence that I hope our listeners will make special note of this sequence where one after another we see these photographs, these portraits of various librarians who really left a mark on the history of public libraries and yet whose contributions are all but completely forgotten were it not for your film. I want to give you a chance to talk about a woman named Ernestine Rose, who plays an especially prominent role in the film and whose story is, I think, especially inspiring.
I do, too. I'm glad you agree. I discovered Ernestine Rose, who, of course, is known to library historians. I don't want to take credit for it, but I had never heard of her. And when I read an article that was written for one of the local newspapers out in the Hamptons. Ernestine Rose grew up in, I want to say, Southampton. I'll have to fact check that one for you. But she grew up on a estate, a very typical middle-class, upper-middle-class, Anglo-Saxon, white, old American family, which is what the typical demographic was for a librarian at that time, except that she was a woman. And she was part of Melville Dewey's first library school. So she was very much swept up in that initial movement. But what Ernestine did was kind of break away several times from the mainstream way of thinking. And along with a lot of other women who were serving new populations, kind of looked at the community and said, this isn't working for us. You know, we need to serve these people in this way. So she got her start on the Lower East Side of New York, where she spoke up and said, no, we don't have to just, you know, of course we want people to learn English. Of course we have books for them in English. We have English classes so people can learn English. But people also just need to escape. And sometimes they want to read in their own language. They want to celebrate their own culture. And she just transformed the programming at her library on that Lower East Side, which was predominantly recent Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, and then also Chinese American immigrants and German. There was a good amount of German population in that neighborhood at the time, too. She then went off to World War I, where the ALA was having all these library programs for soldiers to sort of bring them solace so that they had things to read when they weren't out on the field. She got assigned to serve at what was at that time a segregated army. So she was assigned to a segregated library for black soldiers, where she discovered that not only black soldiers, but many black and white soldiers were still illiterate. So she started teaching English to these soldiers while they were there. And when she came back, instead of sending her back to the Lower East Side, New York Public Library assigned her to Harlem, where she just completely transformed that library. her first main step was that there were no librarians of color in the entire New York public library system. And she went out and found some people who had graduated from library school or were in training, hired them, and together that staff just transformed that library into like a cultural gold mine. It was really the epicenter of the Harlem Renaissance, and all these famous people were there. And then she went on one more, there's one more chapter with her that I really love, which is during World War II, her realizing that fascism was on the rise and that the it was time for librarians to stand up and do something. So in the early history of American public libraries, this idea of book censorship being, or book banning being a bad thing was not part of librarianship. That was their job, as they saw it, was to provide correct and proper reading for their communities. And the thinking started changing around that time, and she was one of the people who wrote the first Library Bill of Rights and spoke up for, like, we're not going to persecute minorities. One of the fascinating things I found is that during World War I, almost all public libraries in the United States got rid of all their books in German. during World War II, that didn't happen. It was more an attitude, I mean, it did happen, but there was also a competing attitude of like, no, wait, we need to know what they're thinking. We need to know what these other ideas are. We're all intelligent, well-educated, or somewhat educated people. You know, part of democracy is us making our own decisions and our own choices and being free to read what we want.
Her story is amazing. It makes me, as I heard about it, and I had knew nothing about her whatsoever. By the time the film was over, I feel like her face should be on the $50 bill. I mean, like, this is an American that all Americans today should know something about, and about her courage. I mean, in being the first librarian where she was stationed to order books in Chinese and books in Yiddish. And another way in which your film brings, for instance, her story so beautifully to life is the sequence in which we see all these different photographs, and you share with us what the captions are. Like, there's one picture, joining the library, and we see this line of young people coming down the stairway and lined up to the desk, and we see every color of the rainbow in that lineup of youngsters. And there's another photograph, Italian boys listening to Pinocchio, and another one, yes, and Yiddish Mothers Club, and so on and so forth. Lucy Faulkner, I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about the sort of treasure hunting that I'm sure you and others who worked on this film did in terms of uncovering such a remarkable photographic legacy in terms of what libraries have been over the years. I mean, without that, this film would not be the film that it is.
Yeah, no, it was... It was definitely a big task tracking down all the, there's over 700 archival pieces in the film, and we had to track down the rights and get permission from all these different archives. You'll see on the credits, it's a long list. but it was so much fun, yeah, going to the National Archives and getting your little library card at the National Archive and going in there and look at the reels, because not everything's online. You have to go into these places and find these little gems. And we went all over San Francisco. We went to New York. We went to the Harlem, to the Schomburg Center. Got some beautiful photos. NYPL gave us a lot of resources. It was, yeah. And then all these little small libraries. But I got to tell you, librarians. They're wonderful at giving, holding the archives of their city or, you know, their people, but they are not good at telling their own story and keeping archives of their own. 'Cause we found photo albums like under the sink in the staff room of these old librarians that were there from, you know, the turn of the century. They were in San Francisco too. Actually, there was a whole treasure chest, a whole closet actually full of these tapes of this television show that they had downstairs in the library, and we found these incredible PSAs from Robin Williams that were just amazing, and they were not categorized. We went in and cataloged all of them, and you think, like, that's the librarian's job, not ours, but it was really fun going through all that and looking at that stuff.
Well, and for you to take up the torch in terms of wanting to tell these stories in a way that maybe some of these librarians have been reticent to do themselves. And of course, there are, it's not just the story of unsung heroes and people we've never heard of. Your film also touches on the legacy, the complicated legacy of Mr. Dewey, as in the Dewey Decimal System, and also Mr. Carnegie, who of course really helped to see to it that a host of beautiful libraries were constructed all across the country. I appreciate the fact that your film takes the time to address the complexity of these two men who, in total, made a positive contribution, but nevertheless, their stories are both problematic. And I should think that was an interesting challenge for you in making this film and telling the story of these two men in particular, to do so in a way that was fair, but illuminating and even-handed.
Thank you. I'm glad you thought that. It's a hard balance to achieve. Patriotic history does not mean whitewashing history, in my opinion. And there are, part of what makes this story great is what people had to overcome, I think. And one of them was incredible sexism. And Melville Dewey was at the forefront of both sides of that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. He really opened the entire profession up to women in a way that it hadn't been before. He lobbied and, like, put himself on the line over and over and over again to allow women into his library school, which was the first professional library school in the world, and certainly the first one to admit women. When it initially started at Columbia, the trustees of Columbia were so resistant to having women on their campus that he had to find rooms off campus that they could hold classes that women were allowed to attend. And then soon after, they shut the whole thing down and he had to relocate the library to upstate New York. So he's given and due a lot of credit as sort of the father of American librarianship, but there's also a whole nother side of him taking advantage sexually, romantically, all different ways, of women who worked under him. And eventually, a lot of these scandals, you know, at that point, nobody talked about that publicly, but eventually these scandals accumulated, and he was sort of pushed out of, as a human being, out of the library world, but never out of the library story. He remained this, like, heroic figure for a long, long time, and he is. But he was also a virulent anti-Semite, and he was incredibly racist and classist, and it's just like, he was a man of his time back then, and a particularly opinionated version of that time. And Andrew Carnegie, same thing. He's seen as the hero of, he's called the patron saint of American libraries. He's seen as the hero of bringing libraries to working people, and yet he also has his own legacy of really exploiting working people as an industrialist, as a steel mill owner, as a union buster, and we try to go into that complexity a little bit. He really, in a lot of ways, is also the father of philanthropy in the United States. He was the person who changed this, like, way of thinking from, like, charity, where you just give money, and to this idea of philanthropy, where you give support to people to help them better themselves. So he was a deep thinker in a lot of ways, but again, flawed. He also did not believe in telling local communities how to run their libraries. So when he gave money to cities in the South, he allowed them to be completely segregated libraries. It wasn't until about a decade later that he started listening to leaders in the Black community and saying, oh, well, maybe I should fund some libraries for them too. So there were a handful of Carnegie, quote unquote, colored or Negro libraries.
It's a complicated story, and I appreciate the fact that you were willing to delve into this complicated story as thoroughly as you do. One of the things I learned, I had no idea that during the civil rights movement, one of the things that occurred on it sounds like a fairly regular basis was sit-ins, not just at lunch counters, we've all heard about that, but sit-ins in public libraries that were segregated. And I imagine that should make you feel good as a filmmaker, Lucy Faulkner, to be telling a story like that that enlarges our understanding of the civil rights movement.
Yes, definitely. It opened my eyes. I had no idea. Yes, of course. I mean, I heard, yes, the Woolworth counters, lunch counters, but I did not know. And what I found really inspiring, though, was that they were run by, they were mostly by kids. I mean, yeah. Young teenagers and young college workers, you know? I mean, students who just, they're the ones who wanted to read the Bill of Rights. And they wanted to get whatever, because, you know, historically, the black libraries didn't have as great of a collection as the white collections, the white libraries. So, yeah, it was fascinating to learn that information. Really fascinating.
Earlier in the interview, you made passing reference to a really amazing family that you were so happy to meet and be able to film. We especially hear from the mother of this large family somewhere, I believe, in rural Wisconsin, with a lot of kids, all homeschooled. And so for this particular family, the public library is indispensable. And it is also this particular mother who figures in your discussion in the film about this whole matter of banning books, and when people have concerns about certain books that are on the shelf in one's library. And I appreciated her contribution, because sometimes it's easy to really paint with a broad brush in terms of who is likely to stand up at a town meeting, for instance, and speak out in terms of banning books. And I appreciate the fact that this issue is handled with some nuance and care in your film, even though clearly you as filmmakers have a passionate belief that at least in most cases the banning of books is something about which we have to be supremely careful.
Exactly, yeah. She was a fascinating character. She, you know, they loved their libraries. They're, you know, a family of 15 homeschooling. Of course she wanted to get them out of the house. Take them to the library so they could read things. And she was very careful they had free range when we were there of the library. They could take out whatever they wanted to, pretty much. But she was, I think, guiding them to more religious spines. They have like little crosses that they're, you know, faith books. But what I really like is that the daughter is, you know, saying, yes, you know, my mom doesn't want us to read certain things because, you know, they're maybe immodest, but I don't agree with her on on everything. They're a fascinating family, and really thankful that they let us film them.
Absolutely. And it just sort of underscores the fact that most of us as human beings are complicated human beings, and we might to some extent appreciate and embrace the idea of the free exchange of ideas and so on, and then once in a while something comes along where it feels like this is a line I do not feel good about crossing. And I just appreciate the way in which your film kind of tackles that. I am also, on a very personal level, so happy that one of the last libraries that we see with our own eyes is a library that I visited a couple of years ago in Salt Lake City, where one of my younger brothers lives. And he had actually lived there for several years and had not yet been inside the Salt Lake City Public Library. And at my insistence, that was one of the things we did one of the days there. All four of my siblings were together. And we went there, and we were blown away. It was just, it's the most incredible-looking facility. And beyond how spectacular it looks is the wide range of offerings, of course. And, of course, that's one of the important themes of your film as well, that public libraries in the 21st century have really had to transform themselves, and the work of librarians is vastly different from what it once was.
That's right, yeah. There's actually, it's, there, that was, the Salt Lake City Library is beautiful, and it's so amazing, and it's so open, and the light comes in there perfectly. It was actually, it's kind of, it was pretty, there was a whole section we had in there earlier on in our, in a cut. It was kind of sad because people, people committed suicide in that library, like off the top, they would jump off, and the poor librarians had to, you know, deal with the aftermath and trauma of that. But librarians, yeah, there's, you know, they, their role has changed a lot, and with the demise of a lot of social services, or not enough social services, that they've become social workers. In fact, San Francisco, we also followed around, the first, they were the first library in the country to give an office and pay the salary of a social worker inside the library. So if there's, you know, there's a lot of homeless people who don't have any place to go, and they go to the library because it's, you know, it's clean, it's safe, it's warm or cool, whatever the temperature is outside. And they, you know, they have issues and they have problems. And if something's coming up that the librarians can't handle, they'll call the social worker to come and talk to the people and, you know, talk them off the ledge. No pun intended there, but it was, it's fascinating that how librarians did, they just keep stepping up, you know, whatever you need, they're there for you.
And one of the most stirring moments in the film comes towards the very end when we see the swearing in of Carla Hayden to be the Librarian of Congress. And she is, I believe, the first woman and the first Black to be given that important title. And looking back over history, which has included shameful instances in which both Blacks and women were excluded from libraries, it is so good to see at least halting progress or uneven progress made in terms of libraries being truly open to all. And there's a wonderful moment where we see some of those stirring words that adorn the entrances to various public libraries, but even public libraries that once upon a time did not quite live up to such high-sounding ideals. It's a remarkable story told so beautifully in this great film, Free for All, The Public Library, airing tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, on the series Independent Lens. And Dawn Logsdon and Lucy Faulkner, the co-producers of this wonderful film. My thanks to you for joining me today, and my congratulations to you on creating such a wonderful film.
Thank you so much. It was lovely speaking with you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Elizabeth Minnick and a truly remarkable book, which is titled The Evil of Banality, The Life and Death Importance of Thinking. And on Wednesday, for the last day of National Autism Awareness Month, Cy Montgomery talks about her biography of Temple Grandin, one of the most famous Americans on the autism spectrum. And then you'll hear a portion of an interview I was privileged to record with Temple Grandin herself. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast today calls for Cloudy skies giving way to mostly sunny skies on a high today of 74 degrees. Our winds at times will gust to more than 40 miles per hour. Increasing clouds overnight with a shower or thunderstorm possible after midnight, possibly even severe, overnight low of 65. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and